I'm Giovanni.
And I'm Jose Rico.
Yeah. And we're going to talk to you about what I think is one of the more interesting and evolving case studies in social engagement. I hesitate to use the phrase social media because social media is actually a very small component of this program, but a lot of the philosophy, a lot of the thinking that has helped social media evolve has informed the program thoroughly. So we like to use the word social engagement. We're going to talk to you about what the program has set out to do, you know, the objectives of the program. We're going to actually share results. The White House actually just released a study 2 days ago. I doubt you've read it. It's 27 pages. We're going to unbundle it for you so we could take a closer look at what those numbers actually mean. And then we want to do what we always do when we go to a new city and talk to folks about what we're trying to do, which is to engage you and get your thinking. So we're going to try to leave enough room, not toward the end, but more like toward the midpoint, you know, to get to that. There's an old saying in the world of social engagement is that you bring your own story first, and then you figure out a way to connect that story to the group. So I thought we should just start with some intros, specific intro to Jose Rico, Executive Director of the White House Initiative for Educational Excellence for Hispanics. A name that's too long, but we'll unbundle that too.
Great. Thank you, Gio. Well, first, it's great to be here in Austin, see Mundo and some other folks here. And I just want to start just a little bit about who I am and how I got to this position. And first is, you know, it's a great honor to be working for the president in this very important initiative of really increasing the educational attainment of Hispanics. You know, my own personal story is that by all indicators, just a short time ago, just a few years ago, I would have thought it was impossible for me to be able to be leading this effort. My parents came from Mexico when they were recently married and brought myself and my brother from Mexico from a small rural town in Mexico to Chicago. And basically, I grew up in Chicago, went to the schools there in Chicago, some of the worst schools in the country, one of the most segregated cities in the country. But because of the lessons that they taught me about hard work and, doing everything you can to provide for the family and helping each other out and really them believing, like a lot of immigrants believe, that if you come to this country, that this country will embrace you, it will become your country. The responsibility that you have is to be able to work hard, contribute, and that the dividends will pay off in the future of having a better life than your parents. So I was able to go through school, was able to go get an engineering degree, work in corporate America, and very soon found out that my calling was really in community service. And I started doing community organizing in Chicago around education rights, specifically around immigrants. I really saw that there was a very vulnerable population that had protections under the law but weren't able to access education. And so I started after 96 doing some very intensive organizing around immigrant rights to make sure that that kids were having access to education. Along that trajectory, I had an opportunity to meet somebody that was also doing organizing before me and started doing some civil rights work and really trying to protect the rights of people in Chicago, this guy named Barack Obama, and I actually then worked for his wife in doing youth development work in Chicago for 4 years in this organization called Public Allies, which was an organization whose mission is to train young people to do public service and to be able to look at how we could come together and look at the assets of communities and try to find solutions. And so my work in community organizing, in preparing young people to do public service, and then ultimately working with a group of parents to be in a hunger strike to advocate and really organize against Mayor Daley in Chicago to open a new school and become a high school principal was what brought me to D.C. When the president asked me in December to be able to serve for him and do education organizing. So
I think we got a photo.
Oh, so that photo is when I first got to D.C. and they were recognizing folks in a Cinco de Mayo celebration. And that's when he, that was the first time he saw me since being elected as president. I just arrived shortly after that and he just stepped out and said, hey, good to see you.
Yeah. So I'll keep my story short. I usually like to start any Latino-focused conference by saying that, yes, I'm Puerto Rican, I'm not Italian. I actually come from the northernmost part of Puerto Rico, which is the Bronx. But I met Jose Rico actually in Silicon Valley just before he launched the formal program. Although the program has been going on for several years, there was a first phase where you just traveled to a lot of cities. He came to an event in Silicon Valley. I'm part of an organization called Latinos in Social Media. And we're just one of many partners that the White House has for this initiative. We want to start the formal part of this this program by looking at what is this program? You know, exactly what are we doing, Jose? And why Hispanics? Because I think we really just need to address that right at the very beginning. I had a number of people comment to me over the last few months, why the extreme focus on Hispanics? And by the way, that doesn't work anymore, right? Segmentation. And you know, there's some interesting answers, and it's probably worth starting the conversation with that question.
Sure, sure.
What is the program and why Hispanics?
So our office was actually started 20 years ago by President Bush I, after a variety of civil rights organizations really met with him and said, we really need to focus on Hispanics educational attainment because it's in crisis right now. 20 years ago, the percentage of adults that Hispanic adults that have a college degree was 9%. The high school dropout rate was over 60%. There was this projection that the population of Hispanics was going to grow significantly, that we're going to have the Hispanics were going to become the new minority. So 20 years ago, this office was established to be able to look at that issue. Forward now, 20 years later, in 2011, Hispanics are now the largest minority in the public school system. We're 1 in 5 of every students across the country. Obviously, you all know here in Texas, we're more than half of the students in Texas, and also in the next 5 years in California. And now Hispanics are in every state, and the biggest growths of over 90% of growth of the Hispanic community are in places like North Carolina, Georgia, Kentucky, Kansas, so on and so forth. And so part of the reason that our office right now is doing all of this work is because we know in the next 40 years, over 60% of the growth in the workforce and of our country and the overall workforce is going to be Hispanic. The growth that we experience based on the census, where we're now more than 55 million people in our country, the growth that we experienced over the last 10 years, the vast majority was from Hispanic households. And now we know that in the near future, 1 out of every 3 children born in our country is going to be Hispanics. So one of the reasons why we think this is very important and why the president really has made this a priority is because if we're going to create the workforce of the 21st century to be able to have skilled labor market and be able to be innovative and how to educate the world, we need to make sure that this population is prepared. And the second reason, obviously, is because one of the things that I firmly believe in, and I think is something, even though our community is so diverse in terms of where we come from, first generation through 10th generation, one of the things that we really believe is that we, the values that we have and the promise that we hold of our country is that we still believe that if you work hard, take responsibility and are responsible, if you become entrepreneurial, that the life of your children are actually the chances of your children being successful in this country are going to increase. And so for us, we really see this as of the Hispanic community being able to fulfill the promise of America. And you know, we've heard that from Jeb Bush and President Obama. That's something that people really understand. And we think that we're going to play a really big role and continue to play a really big role, not only in the economics of our country, not only in the education and the entrepreneurial spirit of our country, but in around the values that our countries have. So that's why we're really focusing on our community.
So, yeah, so Jose, let's, and before we get there, actually, I want to say something about another answer to why Hispanics, which is what we're seeing happen online, you know, with, you know, digital and social,
right,
with Hispanics. But very quickly, Hispanics, I was dragged into this conversation, by the way, 2 years ago when a group called the National Hispanic Corporate Council went to San Francisco and they needed someone to speak on the topic of Latinos and social media. And I didn't know anything about the topic, but Brian Solis was out of town, so I got the gig. And suddenly, you know, obviously I had to learn a lot on this topic, at least well enough to talk. And so what I discovered actually is that Latinos are out-indexing almost every ethnic group on Twitter, Facebook. They buy more cell phones. We tend to click on ads faster. I don't know if Jose Villa's in the audience, but he actually wrote an article about that. It was really interesting when we look at program design, you know, for how you actually design this program for the White House Hispanic Initiative, to look at online as one of several tools, right? But I'm wondering if you could spend some time now just talking about how you've designed the program specifically around events and what you have seen so far. I believe you've been in 15 cities right now, right?
Right.
And I'll go through this little slide collage for you.
Sure. So you know, when we came into office, one of the things that was apparent, and you all know this, right, that we were in a really huge economic crisis. Our communities were hurting all over the place. And one of the first things that the president wanted to do was to be responsive and to be able to try to address these issues head on. The first things he told us in terms of a priority for the administration is to get folks that were recently appointed out in the community and hold listening sessions, town halls around a variety of different issues to see what were some of the recommendations that people had. So we had hundreds of town halls around healthcare, around creating jobs, around education. I mean, Secretary Duncan did all 50 states in the first year. We went everywhere to be able to hear what was going on, and that was our effort to go out there and engage the community because that's who the president is, right? That's his background. We found out three things after all of that time that really informed the work that we're currently doing. The first thing was that people did actually not know what the administration was doing around all of these issues. They heard a lot of the fights in Washington, D.C., a lot of the conflicts, and were really tuning it out, so they did not know what was actually going on with the Affordable Health Care Act. They did not know what was going on and how the stimulus saved over close to 250,000 jobs. They did not know about a variety of different things that really impacted the bottom line and the pocketbooks of individuals. So that's the first thing we heard. The second thing that we heard was that folks actually were glad that the federal government was going to Salinas, California, to San Antonio, to Providence, Rhode Island, you know, to all of these different places from folks in the administration that came from those communities. One of the things that I learned as I was going around the country is the folks from the administration that were going in these different areas actually knew what they were talking about. So in education, you know, I was a high school principal, was an educator for, you know, close to 20 years. People were surprised that people, that federal appointees were going around the country that knew what they were talking about in those issues. So they were happy that we were there. The third thing that they told us was that they wanted to see the federal government play a role of a stakeholder to help them solve some of these issues, which was very different from what we heard on the cable news, that people did not want the federal government in their lives. What we heard in the communities that were hurting the most was, we want you to be a partner at the table. We don't want you to tell us what to do or solve our problems, but we want you to be a partner with us. So those are the things that we heard. And when we did an initial report, when we reported this to the president, what was told to us right away is, let's host and bring 160 leaders from across the country, and let's have a public policy conference to really address these three issues. And we were able to host it last year in July, had 160 leaders. The only reason 160 is the number is because that's the number of chairs in the biggest room in the executive office building, which is not really the White House. It's a building next to the White House. And we held 160 leaders from around the country there. We're close to 90 administration officials, and we use this thing called the open space process to try to generate ideas of how we did it, and that's how we got to where the beginning of the summits.
And it might sound geeky, but it's also close to the so-called Dunbar number, right? The number of people that that you can remember. I don't know exactly what that number is, but yeah. So I attended that first event, and then I've been while you were talking, I advanced a whole bunch of slides of some of the other cities that you visited, and then of course there was this traditional mainstream media which you had to do, big high level discussions, and of course. One interesting platform called Shakira, right?
Right.
I mentioned. So a lot of different, a lot of different things that you did. But to summarize, would you say that it was a combination of organizing, mm-hmm. right? And in fact, some of the traditional stuff that we've learned from movement making, technology, and this new thing that Washington is talking about, which neither Republicans nor Democrats dispute, which is public-private partnerships, right? So can you tell us, before we get into the results, what kinds of partners?
Sure.
Just tell us, give us a few examples of, actual businesses or local government officials and NGOs that
sure.
you've spoken to along
the way. Sure. Yeah. So when we went over, when we had this policy conference again in July of last year, we had a tremendous response from these leaders to say, come to our community, and we want to do what you did in our communities across the country. So we had, we've been to 14 places already. We're actually in San Antonio yesterday with Mayor Castro. But we've gone to places, to these 14 places, Orlando, Miami, Las Cruces, New Mexico, Albuquerque, Las Vegas, New York City, San Jose. We're going to Los Angeles in April. We're going to North Carolina next week, Durham. So we went to all these places, and the format that we used was very simple. We did a very brief, we told all the administration officials, leave your talking points at home. We don't want to bring your talking points. We want you to come into these places, invited by a steering committee of leaders from the community, and we want you to pitch the ideas that you have for the federal officials and the leaders that are there, and using the open space process, pitch ideas that you have that could help government work better with you, and pitch some problems that you are experiencing right now that you think a change in regulation or something different the federal government could help you with. And so in all of these cities that we went to, we heard hundreds of sessions and ideas and ways in which we could work together to be able to solve some of these issues. They were pitched by colleges and universities, again, mayors, governors, small businesses who wanted us to go and figure out how we could work together with them to improve small business regulations. And at the same time, we had government programs and officials going there and announcing new programs at these summits, being able to get a ton of coverage by the local TV stations, by, including Univision, the Twitter town halls with different secretaries, and being able to use the seal of the White House and the brand of the White House to really amplify the different initiatives that the cities were doing and getting this co-branding together to get the word out, get more public participation, and really try to address these issues head on. And we just released a report, like Gio said. We have dozens of examples of new of businesses getting more contracts from the federal government, civil rights being protected by of students, more public-private partnerships of grants from colleges and universities to be able to increase education attainment for students, and a variety of different very concrete outcomes that resulted out of these summits. These summits are all day. They're from 8:30 in the morning till 5 in the evening. The one we just had in San Antonio, we had over 400 people there, and people stayed on a Friday. They were there at 8:30 to hear Secretary Duncan, and a lot of folks did not leave till after 6 o'clock in the evening, because this was the first time they were able to set the agenda with government policymakers, talk to them for hours, learn what other people in that community were doing, that they did not know what they were doing. You know, like many of you that are part of a community, we mostly operate with a small circle of folks that we interact with, and we know that there's something going on. There's a solution somewhere in our community or somebody working on the exact same thing, but there's never a forum for people to come together. We hear a lot of that. And then finally, what we really focus on is putting their next steps and what they're going to do on a web-based platform so that folks in that community could go online, continue those conversations, and then people from different cities could go online and make those connections themselves.
Cool. Yeah, so by the way, not only do people stay late, but they show up really early. And actually, this is astonishing for me because I've done a lot of Latino events, and we usually tell people that they're starting a lot earlier just so they get there in time. So to have 400 Latinos show up on a Saturday morning is astonishing. That happened in San Jose. But let's look at the results. And I'm glad you used the word outcome, Jose, because I think whenever you're reporting results, and I come from the world of marketing, there's always this distinction between output and outcome. They're both important because the outcome at some point can help you map. I mean, the outputs can at some point help you map to the outcomes. But let's start with the output. Let's just start with some of the raw, interesting numbers, mm-hmm. and then start looking at the other kinds of results, things that have actually happened through a different lens.
Right.
So first, if you could just take us through these. So I remember 15 cities, right? 3,000 Hispanic leaders, and we're talking about people at the local level mostly, mm-hmm. right? Businesses, NGOs, local government officials. The federal government officials, you actually got them out of Washington and they went, right?
Right.
And then 500 topics, but what analysis, just based on what you showed us in the report, five big themes. And I think that, bucketizing that you've done is actually very helpful. What are those
sure.
five big things?
Yeah, the themes should be no surprise to anybody here because these are the themes that are important to everybody's lives, right? Whether you're, college students or you're a grandparent, the themes that folks really wanted to talk about were the economy. How are things going with the economy? What are things that are happening right now that are going to help us grow and get a job and making sure that we push forward on that? And what can the federal government do to support small businesses or ways to grow the economy? The second thing was education. As many of you here probably know, we've been able to do a ton of things in education, both from K-12 and higher education, to really help folks. The healthcare, a lot of folks, did not know about what was going on with the new healthcare law, that there's these state-level exchanges going on now, and the very big issues that are being implemented now in healthcare. Immigration in the Hispanic community obviously is huge. That is something that many people at the site said, well, if you guys are going to come to X city, you guys better be prepared to get slammed by immigration because that's a really big issue that we're going to hit you hard with. And every city we went to, we would speak for 3 or 4 hours around this issue. People would yell at us. People at the end of the day understood what all the things that we were doing, and the consensus is we all need to do more. And then the last issue that, again, people wanted to talk about heritage and where we were going as a country. So those were the five things that in all those topics were able to be put into some of those buckets.
Yeah, so one of the interesting things about those five persistent themes is that at a grassroots level, you actually got a very close look at the community mm-hmm. and asked them what matters to you. And that's kind of a big deal because it's not like there's a single Hispanic tribe.
Right.
Something that I personally have looked at very carefully. Big differences culturally between Puerto Ricans, New York, Mexicans from California, Cubans in Miami.
Right.
But there are things that unite us, and understanding the things that unite can actually help anybody who's connecting with Latinos to scale, right? Because if you could just find those things that actually bind, you can have this really big network effect. So I find that really interesting. But now, looking at outcomes, just looking at outcomes and studying the report that you just released, I think something that wasn't really pronounced, we had a discussion earlier today, but was really implicit, is that there is a theory of government here that you're experimenting with, and it was more of a hypothesis, and now you're really practicing it. But the idea is that there is a role for federal government, but there's a greater role on the edges, for citizens. What is that relationship? How do you actually find the right balance, and what should you be trying to design for? And looking at the, at what you've actually accomplished, I think there were several things that really stood out. One was, there were a lot of folks that just really didn't know that there were government services available, right? And that was almost like the biggest thing in the first chunk of the article where you looked at jobs and economy. Small business owners didn't know what help was available to them. And then there was a lot of interaction where, you actually had great meetings and people spoke to each other for the first time. Then the last thing, some stuff is actually getting off the ground, right? So that's really interesting. You see this continuum, which might be the way of looking at this. Now, if you were to give yourself a report card, maybe, not now, because this is an interim report, I imagine it might look something like this, and I want to credit somebody from my business, Deloitte, Chris Hewer, who came up with this thing called the Engagement Cube. And what this might show you is, look, if these are the things that you're trying to do, and the going from left to right actually shows you how good a job you have done. If these all light up green, you're doing really well. If they light up red, you might have some problems, but you could look at these strategically. By the way, red as in stop, not as in its other sense, right? But you're not ready to do this now, but what kind of grades would you give yourself so far?
Yeah, I think part of what has driven the work that we're doing is, I explained a little bit about my background, and this is actually obviously the background of the president, is that for many years, myself, I'm never, as a high school principal, as a community organizer, I've never ever said, hey, why don't I call the federal government to help us out on this issue, right? That was never at all, ever, even anything I ever thought about. It's like, the joke with us is, yeah, I'm from the federal government, I'm here to help. So we never thought about it in that way. I think what's really important in terms of the way we're seeing how we're governing is that the first and foremost is that we definitely want to be responsive and efficient with whatever services, protections, or ways in which we could help improve the economy and improve how we work with individuals. So I think in many respects, you could go in terms of the economy where we are now versus where we were 3 years ago. I think that's something that we could give ourselves some good marks, even though we're not where we wanted to be. But I think, so that's one area. I think in the area of healthcare and health, one of the things that I think that if you are not aware of this, I would urge you to look at this. One of the most innovative parts of the federal government is the way in which we're putting out there to the public a variety of health indicators, a variety of data that we asked folks like people from South by Southwest, the technology community, to be able to go out there and gave people all of this data to be able to see if they could design applications or way for us to improve health of communities. So one of the things that we did where we had a competition that we gave all the data in the community of the infant mortality, people who have receiving federal assistance, dropout rates, abuse rates, all of this different data. And the challenge that we gave web developers is, with all of this data, pick one thing in which you think you could use technology to help improve the life of people in the poorest communities, the unhealthiest communities. We need something to be able to do this. The winning person to use this data and interact with the government is somebody came up with a smartphone application that they receive texts when somebody is pregnant and to receive prenatal care. And instead of going to the doctor to be able to do prenatal services, that individual was getting texts about what they should be looking for as their pregnancy progressed, the nutrition that they should be receiving, the community services in that area that will help them out if they have any health issues. And there's a variety of examples within the federal government now on Tuesday to be able to facilitate that. Another quick example is this Tuesday, the Federal Aid and Financial Services Administration in the Department of Education is about to release the raw numbers of how many high school students have filled out a FAFSA form of every high school in the country. So we're just going to release the numbers. We're just going to be able to make it public. So now if you are a parent and you want to know whether the high school that your kid goes to or is going to enroll, or if you want to know how good the school your parents are, this includes private schools, by the way. If you want to know how good a school is and actually sending kids to college, you could click on find that school and see whether there's 1,000 high school students filling out the FAFSA form or 10 high school students filling out the FAFSA form. What we want to be able to do is provide that data and figure out with other indicators what is a way in which we could use crowdsourcing technology to make that data useful to people in the community so they can make good choices and hopefully improve the educational outcomes of, improve the qualities of schools. So these are examples we could do that in health, we could look at it in education, obviously in jobs and the economy, where we're going from being responsive and trying to address these issues and, you know, increasing Pell Grants or providing more financial aid services to individuals into having a real interaction between leaders and entrepreneurs to be able to make this information accessible and useful to folks. It's not just about us working with states and working with officials. We really want to be able to give it out there and see who could help us come up with these tools to really have this meaningful interaction to improve outcomes in our communities.
Okay, cool. So we looked at the theory of government that you obviously have. It was, again, implicit in the report. I think it could probably be expressed a lot more aggressively, maybe by somebody else. Maybe that would be appropriate, I think. We also looked then, at a way to look at, measuring, monitoring what you're doing, which I think is important because if this case study continues to get attention, it's going to have to be, defensible. Let's look at some of the levers that you have, some of the things that you've learned that can help you adjust these things, because I think that's also one of the remarkable things of the study. There were at least five things that I saw. One was you found ways to increase the flow of knowledge. And some of this is technology focused, some of it's not, right? But looking at technology, there are a number of different online tools, and I would say it goes beyond that. You're now actually looking at the application of social data, with something that you didn't start out with, but you're looking at now.
Right.
Then it's the event design, which you guys have really advanced, very well, as far as I can tell. Enabling and monitoring work to get done. I thought that's interesting because if the government has more of an orchestrator role, by the way, we're seeing the same thing in the corporate sector. There's this theory now that headquarters does something, the field does something else. We're seeing this in the automobile industry, we're seeing the restaurant industry. You're doing it here for government, but how do you make sure the work gets done? How do you know that's happening? And then finally, there's this idea of the long tail, and you gave me an example today. There are some things that just wouldn't matter, wouldn't make the top priority list for federal government, but can make the top priority list for somebody locally. What can headquarters, meaning the White House, the ultimate headquarters, do to enable that? So what I'd like to do is actually, I'd like to get your response to each of those things, the way you've learned how to apply those levers. And I'd love to ask the folks here, sitting with us, to help us think through this, because one great thing about South by Southwest is that we do have people that know a lot about each of these topics. So can you give us your
sure? And I'm going to go through this really quick because I want to hear your response. So the first thing is obviously not just in the Hispanic community but across the board, people just do not know of all the things that we were doing. One quick example: in December, the president announced this new change in regulations for student loans called income-based repayments. Has anybody, if you raise your hand, anybody know what income-based repayment is? All right, we have two people. How many people, three people. How many people here have federal student loans? Okay, so if you have a federal student loan, you should know what income-based repayment is because it's a way in which your loan payments that you're making could be reduced to no more than 10% of your annual salary. Your interest rate is, your loans could be consolidated. Your interest rates could also be reduced to no more than 3%. And if you do some kind of public service work after 10 years, your loan is forgiven and given as a grant, right? So this is something that the president made in an announcement, press conference. He's something, you know, we have it on the Federal Financial Aid website. Not many people know about it. And the way that we're using, you know, Shakira has 9 million Twitter followers, right? We're trying to get the word out in a variety of different platforms, just some very basic knowledge. And we're actually going to, one of the purposes of us going to all of these communities is to get the word out to these type of things across the country. In terms of the online tools, right now, one of our best friends is the Google Docs and all the Google tools that we're using. That's something that we use also. But we also have and are looking for more partners to have a platform to be able to have communities share their best practices from one place to another. So one thing just in education, we know that people have solved the education problems that we have today. People have solved how to create a great school, how to get a good early learning program, how to do a great adult education program. And we're able to do these in these different parts around the country, but very few people have been able to do this all throughout the whole pipeline, and we're trying to create these tools where people could interact and share those best practices. We just started that, and we're looking to improve that. The offline rules is constant engagement. The reason we are on the road all the time is because this is something that's really important, and we like to hear from folks, and people are surprised that we're actually open to listening, and we don't come necessarily with an agenda. That's where when the White House goes, and we don't have an agenda besides trying to figure out how we could solve problems.
Jose, if I could interrupt just one thing there. One thing that I found really interesting is the kind of space that you usually get, the school systems.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that for a moment?
Because yeah.
I think it's amazing how much amazing space there is at the community college system, but that's just one, you know, space
yeah.
for you guys.
So we do these in the community. I mean, again, thinking from a community organizing perspective, to us it's second nature to hold these events in community centers, high schools, elementary schools. We don't have these things in hotels. We don't have these things in government buildings. We have all of these events at the community level. And for us, that's a great way to engage folks. We have a structure with where the community forms a steering committee, and they're the ones that basically organize the events, and we show up with the administration officials. And the way we monitor the work is the federal government have agencies all over the country. A quick example, where we're in Las Vegas, the big issue there in Las Vegas was around immigration. We have a regional offices in all the different federal agencies, whether it's labor, health and human services, homeland security. The way we monitor is we invite those individuals to participate in those discussions. And then once they have a to-do list, if they don't do them, the White House Domestic Policy Council kindly says, why haven't you done it? And you made a commitment, what's the follow-up? Usually when the regional offices get a call from the White House to follow up on something they said they were going to do, they do it. And that's something that is new because we really want to make sure that the federal government, not just in D.C., but in our regional office, do that. Mm-hmm. And just finally, the report is a compilation of all of these little actions that we've been able to do collectively that are really having an impact just the way in which people see the federal government and how they're acting as citizens to try to get things done.
Cool. So, yeah, so that could be the future of, you know, the White House. They're going to actually be calling people. Did you get your job done?
Did you get your
cool,
job
done? So we want to turn it to you folks now. Questions on any of these levers or anything else that you want to ask or talk about here? No? So you?
Hi, thanks. Very inspiring work you're doing. Two big picture questions. One, you said that to work on this actually started on Bush 1, if I understood correctly, in terms of thinking about the Hispanic community and the growth and therefore the needs for challenges for it. One, how do you make sure that the work that you're doing gets sustained regardless of whatever happens in November and 4 years from then? And two, how can this model, or is this model being replicated for other groups?
Great question. So what this office started under 20 years ago, and what we're hoping and what we're banking on is that this network of leaders that we've put forward that are right now trusting the responsiveness of the federal government, regardless of what happens in November, that they're going to continue to advocate that that continues to happen. That's one of the things that we see ourselves as, again, this is from the community. Our theory of governing is that we need to make government more responsive, more interactive, and accountable to citizens. So those are the principles that when we go to the communities and we have the community set the agenda and we don't set it, we hope that that's something that, that those steering committee members continue doing, and we're very explicit that that's the role we want them to do. We tell them to hold our feet to the fire in any of these issues around immigration, around education, and so on and so forth, because it's our responsibility to deliver. So that's one thing we make very explicit with community members, and we hope that continues. And the second piece, our office is a Hispanic initiative. What the White House Office of Public Engagement has now just started 2 weeks ago, doing exactly what we're doing with the GLBT community, African American community, women, young people. And so now they're starting to do what we're doing because of how effective it's been.
Thanks for your time here. For the Hispanic community, what platforms and what tools have you seen success with, both from the White House directly with the community, and also what have you heard at the local level people who are having success with? What particular platforms and tools?
Sure. You're talking about technology platforms?
Yeah. I mean, for especially engaging and what the Hispanic community members were able to have more success with. Was it more through video or Twitter or SMS? What tools do you think are more successful for the Hispanic community in terms of socializing these issues?
Yeah. So I think maybe one way to answer that question is for what purpose. So for discovering, more Latinos that want to be engaged, and for and also for communications, the marketing side, of the program. We're finding that Twitter and Facebook by far, and there's reason for that. As I said earlier, Latinos over-index, and not only that, there are also a number of different groups that have organized that can actually help any organization, whether it's public or private sector, to reach the market more effectively because they've organized themselves. So Latism is just one of them. There's a group called Hispanicize. There are maybe half a dozen, and it's pretty big, remarkable organizations. They're mostly grassroots, and both federal government, state government has started looking at this group. So I would not look just at the technology, but the people, the communities that have actually organized. And the question of other, because you're using technology also for collaboration, we do have a collaboration tool that right now has a lot of use for monitoring the work.
Yeah, and so the tool we're using is a third party, a group that's working with us called LaPlaza.net. La Plaza, the meeting place, .net. And that's where through all of these summits, people have go in, they do their reports, they identify their next steps, and they're able to participate in these online discussions within that city and also across cities. So right now we just started that, and we're hoping to grow it. But again, from our perspective, we want to be able to work with organizations like Latism, La Plaza, and any other Foursquare, Google Plus. We'll use whatever to be able to get the word out.
Question in the back, sorry. Yeah, if you wouldn't mind, yeah, it would be easier.
So a two-part question. The first part I think you've answered, which is the follow through. So if you meet with a community, the community doesn't take that point of engagement and move it forward, the White House calls and says, WTF.
Right.
Okay. Where does it go then beyond that? So the engagement started. At what point do you loop back into the cycle and create the reporting structure, which then leads to the case study, which then leads to the success story being told through a variety of channels? How does that work?
Sure. So that's a great question. So at the summit, when people come up with their issue, at that site, they report their issue, they report who was in that table, and then they put on their next steps right there on that platform, laplaza.net. What ends up happening afterwards is we look at all of the issues when we go back to DC, and what we've seen is about two-thirds of the issues are local issues that need to be addressed around local issues that do not have any government involvement, and many of those issues are the next steps, and some of the successes, frankly, we don't hear about because they increased their organization, they were able to collaborate, they raised more awareness, and didn't have anything to do with the federal government, and those are great. We love to capture those stories, and we want to, but the ones we focus on is around the third of them that really have to do with federal-based issues. Federal employment, again, federal financial aid, small business issues, housing. So what happens is we receive those, we look at those. We have one person in our office whose whole responsibility is to follow up with the federal officials that were at that summit and say, what's the follow-up? And we have a little form for the federal officials that said, what's the follow-up? So we contact them, and they basically set up follow-up meetings with their district offices. They provide technical assistance. They are able to resolve many of those issues. A lot of times is that somebody submitted an application and they haven't heard from the federal government in months, and all they want to do is have somebody to give them an answer to follow up on that. Other times it's really serious discrimination complaints that they take to us because we're there, and then we are able to follow up and see how we could resolve them. And so our own accountability measure is these reports are public, and so anybody who is at the summit that wants to see whether anything was done on the federal side, they could go and see if there was any resolution. What we do on our end is we do monthly conference calls. We started doing monthly conference calls with the sites. This report is something that we want to put out there to show other folks that there's actually some outcomes, and we actually are hosting many of these individuals that do these in follow-up meetings with secretaries, with other administration officials. When they go back, say, for example, to San Antonio, we invite the individuals that had that issue to follow up with those folks. So it's a lot of work on our end. That's just the constituency services. That's the way we look at it. But it's right now it's manageable because, again, out of those hundreds of issues that we've seen, the federal issues are about a third. But again, we're looking for ways in which we want to be able to use technology to help that accountability there and for us to be able to address more of these issues.
Yeah, I think actually the new jobs, you know, we're talking about the new role of government. So government's orchestrating, government's calling you sometimes, like with the, you know, the W2F, FTF question. But it has to impact, you know, human resources too, like who does what job. So that would be something interesting, I think, to report back at some point, because a lot of folks will be interested. Do you have a question?
Yeah, so I ask this of White House people all the time, so I'll ask again. And that has to do with sort of migration of this approach to a part of the federal government that touches everybody and everybody touches, and that's the IRS. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, the last time I said this, I was at a meeting in Washington in which people were talking about the use of gaming to help people understand the government, and I suggested that the people are playing a game all the time with the government on April 15th, and it would be cool if that actually turned into a real game instead of its current structure, which is archaic and strange. So my question is this sort of innovation and attempt to use these sorts of networks and this sort of mechanism propagating to other parts of the government, and especially into the IRS, where my sense is that they're doing things the way they've always done them, not necessarily very effectively.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the IRS doing this in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I don't have a very clear answer to this, but I can tell you that in my own work, we've had a lot of discussions in federal government and state governments that are interested in using a network approach, simply because of the doing more with less thing. You know, but they're beginning to understand some of the other advantages, like the long tail, things that they can't do, you know, because they simply just don't have the resources. So it's not just doing the stuff that they're doing currently more effectively, but doing new stuff. And it's a pretty big discussion right now. I think it's changed. I've not done a lot of work in the public sector, but what I understand from folks that have, that this is fairly recent. You know, all the stuff that's been happening here, South by Southwest, around Gov 2.0, it's really becoming real now. That's interesting. I'm sorry, did you have another question? Was there somebody else?
Is there somebody?
Thank you. One more. You delineated a third are federal-based issues that you address, and two-thirds are another level of government or societal issues.
Right.
Do you take any onus or impetus for that two-thirds to act as a facilitator or an aggregator of information? Because for government to be relevant, it's all obviously about sharing of information. Do you see a role for that in yourselves, in your day-to-day activities, when you're planning these opportunities for people to gather and discuss?
So for the third that do not have to do with local government issues, the role that we're playing is, I think we're playing a very, and the only reason I'm saying this is because we get told this a lot, is that in many communities, you need an outside party to convene a variety of different interests and leaders for them to get together. Sometimes if one group convenes a meeting, other folks will not come. And the diversity of stakeholders there, from the education field, the you know, the nonprofit field, the religious leaders, a variety of different, do not come together. So we see us just bringing them together to talk about issues that they have self-interest in actually working on. That's the huge role that we're playing. The other part with the government role, what we've hear and on the ground is that most of those have to do with the local political leadership. So we hear a lot about the governors are doing this, the state reps are doing this, can you do something and tell the governors to act this way? We are very clear that that is not our role as a federal government. We cannot go into states and see if they could change laws, because many of these laws are state laws, and so we are very clear in the limited role that we could play in trying to convince a governor or a state to change state laws. What we do is we let them know what we're doing at the federal level, and the position that the president has and the administration has around these very important issues. But oftentimes we do have these leaders come to us begging for some kind of action around these issues based on the current state laws that have recently been passed or are currently in the books, and they want to change them.
Question here.
I was curious about the process of inviting the community to this summit, especially, you know, immigration being such an issue. So if you can talk a little bit about how did you go about creating a safe space for community members to make sure that it was representative, and sometimes it wasn't just, I mean, necessarily the type A personalities that show up at these summits and, mm-hmm. and speak for the whole community. Sure. So maybe about the process of how we made sure that everyone was welcomed at the table.
Sure. So, you know, again, you know, organizing 101, the first thing is we spent 2 years building relationships with leaders on the ground. So this is not something that we could have done in 2009. This is something that we built those relationships over those 2 years, and now the leaders know us, and so now they trust us. And so we asked them to form a steering committee of youth, immigrant rights activists, chambers of commerce, professionals, religious leaders. And when all those people come around the table, what we do is we say, invite who you want. Invite who you think need to be at the table to work with DHS officials, White House officials, to be able to address the issues that are important to you. So we basically give them the invitation, and they send it out to their networks. And so for us, it's really, you know, build that relationship, trust your leadership and provide them the information and the tools to be able to bring people together and talk about these very tough issues. 5 minutes. Okay. We have time for
a couple more questions. Yeah, then we can wrap up. Oh, and there's one in the back, right?
Hello? Okay. Someone tweeted me a question, actually. They said, given the new outreach methods, have you seen an increase in high school graduation rates or college enrollment among Hispanics?
That's a great question. We've actually seen a tremendous increase in college enrollment and a slight but significant increase in high school graduations. I think it's for a lot of different reasons. Like the main reason we know because of the study that was recently done by the Pew Hispanic Center on this is that the president has made college aid significantly, both in the Pell Grants and in the loan front. And the second reason is that a lot of the work on the ground by hundreds of community organizations in raising awareness of the importance of college to Hispanic families, their work has been tremendous. So the fact that it's not just that our numbers have increased significantly for the college going age population, but the president almost doubled the Pell Grants, and again, it significantly reduced the student loan rates, and I explained with our IBR regulations, that a lot more people are going to college. At the high school end, we've increased the number of high school graduates by 4%. Which again it doesn't sound like a lot, but we basically have been flatlined for many years, and part of that is because the president allocated close to $5 billion in turning around the dropout factory. So we know 2,000 high schools around the country that drop out 70% of the Hispanic students in our country. We know those 2,000 high schools, and the president allocated close to $5 billion on providing resources to increase the school day, provide better professional development for teachers, raise the standards, do after-school programming, and engage parents. More than $2 million per high school for the next 5 years on those areas. And so we're starting to see improvement in that.
Any other questions? Okay. Okay, so we're going to wrap up on the question of courage. This was issue number 5, and what I want to do is just share something with you that I do at like practically every conference where I talk about Latinos and engagement, and it's just something that I uncovered. Just doing a quick history. Everyone knows this story, right, of how the Chavez campaign informed the Obama 2008. The work that Chavez did for UFW informed the sloganeering, basically, for the political campaign. But a lot of people are not familiar with all the learning of community organizing, that went into this campaign. And one thing I found that was interesting was not just that, but there was actually a single person, somebody who worked for Chavez, then worked for Obama. He got a lot less credit than the social media guys. And then, maybe just a couple of years later, he was out in the Middle East helping with some of the civic groups that ultimately helped create the Arab Spring. And his name is Marshall Gantz. He's not Latino, but he's an honorary Latino. He grew up with Chavez. And the reason why I like to tell this story is not just to show, this interesting lineage of, of learning, which is community organizing, right? But it's also to show that, not only are Latinos really active in the digital world, but they, they've actually helped create some of the thinking. And I have shown these three slides in a number of places, including Puerto Rico, where they were completely unfamiliar, actually, with the history of si se puede to yes we can. They actually thought it was the other way around. They thought, oh, didn't they just translate it for Spanish? A little bit shocking, right? But what I think is happening is an opportunity for Latinos to reimagine themselves and rebrand themselves with this power. What's your thought? I know, for me, it's a little different because I just consult. you actually have a responsible position in government. What's your take? What do you say to folks when talking on the issue of heritage?
Yeah, well, when we talk about this issue at the White House, it's very clear to everybody there that the future of our democracy, the future of our economy, how we're going to create the new entrepreneurs, how we're going to educate, be the most educated country in the world, that future rests on the Hispanic community. We know that. Part of what we see is that we've had these values and we really believe in the American promise. Recently, many of you have heard that many people right now are doubting whether their kids are going to be better off in the future. That is something that is still unwavering in our community. We see ourselves as carrying those values in these next 10, 20 years, continuing that movement, being able to really show everyone that the American promise to have a better life for your family if you work hard, if you play by the rules, if you pay your fair share, that is still possible. And so the way we look at it is that if we're able to do that with the Hispanic community, everybody benefits, and it's really going to restore that American promise. And that's what I'm committed to. That's what the office is committed to. And the president is very clear that given the demographics and the history that we've had since the founding of our country and where our country is going, that we play a big role and people in our community are ready and have been playing that role, and we're going to play that role.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Jose. It's been great fun hanging out with you guys, and I look forward to next few months.
Great, and thank you, Ann, for being here. Appreciate it.